Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 14th of July. Monday at 9, we do all things political, and we have two guests with us for the hour. Rachel Sklar will be joining us the first half hour, media and special projects editor of the Huffington Post. Chase Martin, who's managing editor of the Iowa Independent, will be joining us the second half hour of this hour. A lot to talk about. Rachel has written, and many of you haven't had a chance to see this cover, so you may want to go to HuffingtonPost.com, which shows a very controversial New Yorker cover, and Rachel wrote about this in a piece yesterday. The cover is titled The Politics of Fear, and according to the New Yorker press release, it satirizes the use of scare tactics and misinformation in the presidential election to derail Obama's campaign. And Rachel writes, what's that they say about repeating a rumor? We'll talk about that. We'll look at the economy, which seems to be in worse and worse shape. Barack Obama wrote a piece in today's New York Times with plans for leaving Iraq and includes information about his beefing up forces in Afghanistan. And we'll discuss the general presidential race this hour of the show and welcome your phone calls, as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050, or send an email if you'd like to do that. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Rachel. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the New Yorker cover. I know a lot of people haven't had a chance to see it. For me, it comes later in the week, but if they go to the website, they'll be able to see it now, and you wrote a piece about it yesterday. It's a fairly controversial cover, eh? What?
It is. Yeah. I'm a little bit surprised at the outcry. I mean, even having written about it as soon as I saw it, that it was going to be big. It's pretty big.
Yeah. And tell me why people find it offensive. It's supposed to be satirical, correct?
Right. And I understood that when I saw it.
Right.
I didn't think that the New Yorker has knowingly putting forth anti-Obama propaganda. But the reason people are finding it offensive is because it embodies virtually all of the most negative rumors and smears and false stereotypes about the Obamas that have, you know, been so hard to eradicate over the course of this campaign. You've got Michelle Obama with a giant afro, packing an AK-47 and ammo and military fatigues, looking like, you know, the most militant revolutionary, which plays into the Whitey rumor, which was, there has been absolutely no basis in fact for that, but claims that some secret video exists are still out there. And then you've got Obama dressed in a turban and robes to play into the Muslim rumor. And again, that is a smearing rumor. Obama has said repeatedly that he is a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, the whole flap about Jeremiah Wright was about church. And then the whole thing takes place in the Oval Office, where there's a portrait of Osama bin Laden hanging on the wall,
mm-hmm.
Just above a fireplace in which an American flag burns. So the imagery is really not subtle.
Right.
But the point is clear, and it's such a extreme, a cartoonish version of everything that anybody who is remotely familiar with the situation obviously knows that the point is to lampoon the ridiculousness of all of these smears.
Mm-hmm. Did you find it offensive when you saw it?
Oh, I didn't find it offensive at all, but I knew it was a big deal.
I thought,
I was like, whoa. That was sort of my reaction. I didn't find it offensive, but I knew instantly that people were not going to like it.
Right.
I recognized that had it been, see, it's so interesting, you know, the source of these things are important. Had this cartoon been on the cover of a far-right magazine or had been in a far-right newspaper, the reaction would obviously be different. But it would fit in there. It would be irony-free. It
mm-hmm.
would lack
mm-hmm.
the context that the New Yorker brings to it, which is, you know, saying to its educated audience that this is ridiculous and we're sending it up.
Right.
And so I got that. But
mm-hmm.
just because I get it doesn't mean that that obviates the reality that there are so many people out there who really think this is true.
I know. And where are they getting that information that this is who they are? Is that coming through very right-wing blogs, or who's saying that?
You know, I mean, there are, first of all, I think that there are these phantom emails that keep circulating. There's that. There's there's the misinformation that is passed over back fences and in conversation. I actually, a few months ago, was in a conversation with a smart, sort of with-it friend of mine, and this sort of came up in conversation, and she said, oh, he's not a Muslim? And I really turned around. I was in shock. I said, come on. So even if you're, people who aren't tuned into the frequency of those elections, like political junkies, may hear stuff by osmosis and may not get the nuance. I mean, it really is astounding and ridiculous at this point that anybody could not be aware. There's just
right.
such information overload in our world. But these rumors persist, and then there's the constant questioning. There's subtle ways of perpetuating these things by leaving sort of open-ended questions. The patriotism questioning. Now, do we really know? What do we know about Barack Obama? He's so new. Why isn't he wearing a flag pin? Why isn't he a patriot? Why doesn't he love his country? And you hear those things. You hear them even on sort of educated and even sort of liberal-slanting news shows. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard that so many times now. We don't really know about Barack Obama, or why does he love this country? And he has said that flat out. He said it at the beginning of his speech on race, in March, he said, nowhere in the world could my story be possible other than the United States of America. Talking about his heritage, talking about being married to a woman who has the blood of slaves and slave owners in her veins, having members of his family who are black, who are white, a polyglot situation, and rising to be a nominee for president of the United States. It's a truly amazing story, and I would think, I'm a Canadian. So for me, that's more than enough to ground his patriotism. And yet you constantly hear this questioning. So it's a combination of the blatant rumors, but then the more quiet questioning. And that's what I think people are worried that this cover is going to play into.
Right. It is hard to believe this election has gone on forever, that people don't have a more basic understanding of who this guy is. Although
the irony is that we live in an age where there is more information available than any other election mm-hmm. in history. Anyone who has questions about Barack Obama can type his name into Google and see what comes up. I mean, that's also part of the problem is that, there will be things that aren't correct online, but someone who wants to educate themselves would ideally be going towards, going for credible news sources and reading a whole bunch of stuff. And that's what people should be doing. That's what voters should be doing. This is an election. You gotta know what you're doing.
Right.
What you're voting for.
The article is very interesting because it does give a lot of new information about Barack Obama on the south side of Chicago and the daily politics and the Chicago Democratic Party, etc. I found it very interesting.
Well, that's the pity about this is that there's one cover and a 15,000 word article, which is a lot of words.
Yes.
It's a big article, and that actually adds to the answer to the question, who is this guy,
mm-hmm.
and provides some background. And Ryan Lizza is a fantastic writer and reporter. Really, just has been covering this election cycle for the New Yorker and has written about Obama, has written about all the candidates. And so that's sort of been overshadowed here. But I think also one of the reasons is, this literally just became available yesterday and it's 15,000 words.
Yeah,
so
interesting.
Hard to do everything.
Let's talk about the economy for a moment. I don't fully understand
sure.
all of this, but it seems as though things are going down the tubes here. There's Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and mortgages and people's houses becoming even less valuable than they were a couple weeks ago. This is certainly, I think, the issue in the campaign. The number one issue for Americans is that they're losing their assets. And I'm wondering how you think both candidates, Rachel, are responding to this number one concern.
Well, the funny thing is that this has been, this time has been earmarked by the candidates for foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
Obama's going overseas to do, a little European and Middle Eastern tour. And McCain just wants to talk about foreign policy too, but you can't ignore what is happening. And it's not only Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's Indie Mac Bank going under and having to be rescued by the government. I mean, that's a big deal.
Right.
The infrastructure is now showing signs of the strain, and it's sort of reminiscent of back in March when, you know, morning of St. Patrick's Day, you woke up and Bear Stearns was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the infrastructure, the important bastions of infrastructure in this country, and that I agree. You know, it's a huge issue. It's the huge issue, and that's one of the reasons why John McCain, you know, threw his longtime ally and friend Phil Graham under the bus so fast when he made those comments last week about how this was a mental recession. It's not a mental recession. It's real.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that both candidates are really responding to people's fears here, right? That they have some kind of broad vision that the American people wants, we want to hear?
Well, I think that's what they're saying. I think they're both talking about what plans they have and what they're going to do. And actually, it was really interesting on Meet the Press just yesterday, Carly Fiorina from McCain and Claire McCaskill for Obama talking about this stuff and their plans. And I thought Claire McCaskill made great sense when she talked about the fact that Obama only wanted to raise taxes for the top 2% of the population and cut them for lower income Americans. To me, that makes sense. I'm not an economist, but I think more to the point, it's this has caught everybody by surprise. I think the depth and breadth of the crisis, and so I think that the campaigns are struggling sort of to get out there and to get a sense of what their economic plan is, and more than that, because most people aren't going to listen to the fine print of the economic plan, even though, you know, that's the most important thing. But they just want to get a sense of who knows what they're doing and who will sort of right the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's about message, and they're still getting that out. And again, that's the other reason that McCain had to distance himself from Phil Graham so much. I mean, McCain and his wife are millionaires, and they don't have anything to worry about. So for someone so closely associated with the financial background and the economic expertise of his campaign is dismissing what's really happening to regular Americans who are losing their homes as whining,
right.
You know, you got to distance yourself from that real fast.
Let's welcome phone calls for Rachel. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. All things political for this Monday at 9. And Rachel is the media and special projects editor for The Huffington Post. We start our calls with Scott from Madison. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Not only are McCain's millionaires, so are the Obamas now.
Right.
It's a question of scale, but yes, absolutely. But I was referring specifically to the Phil Graham comments.
Right. So the one thing that I think the Democratic Party could have done is they could have gotten a little bit ahead of the game for Barack on some of these rumors. Because if you remember correctly, I mean, the whole Muslim thing, I think the first time anybody knew Barack's middle name was Hussein was from Bob Kerry. And then you had the president of BET television, you know, talking about what Obama was doing in the hood that he shouldn't be doing. And then you had Bill Clinton, you know, they even voted for Jesse Jackson when I ran. I mean, I think the Democratic Party and the Democrats should have been a little bit more aggressive with some of the innuendo and some of the things that they threw out there that really kind of caused some of this to continue for Barack.
Well, I think what's really interesting is what you conflated in there. You know, we started out talking about specifically the Muslim rumor, and then you threw in comments, the Bob Kerry comments were, references to, very minor drug usage that he had copped to in his book. And the Bill Clinton comment was comparing Barack Obama's win in South Carolina to Jesse Jackson's win in South Carolina, which many people felt was meant to marginalize him as a purely African American candidate. So I do. I think that you know that's a sort of a case in point. A lot of this stuff does get rolled together. What you're talking about is strategy. My personal feeling is, if your middle name is Hussein, own it and don't get outraged when people use it. So that by owning it, then it means nothing when you know people on Fox make a point of saying Barack Hussein Obama. You say, yeah, that's my name. You know, thanks for the bulletin. But these are elements of strategy, and I'm not entirely sure how else the Democrats could have reacted. It did seem to me that there was, you know, a pretty quick smackdown when Smear reared its ugly head, and the Obama campaign has that website now, I think it's called fightthesmear.org, about countering all of these falsities. But you know that's the thing about rumors. When things are whispered and passed between people via email, and you've got someone sounding super knowledgeable and they really don't know what they're talking about, and they tell a big group of their friends, "Oh, absolutely, I know this," and they say that to anybody who will listen. That's the stuff that's really hard to counter.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. And our guest is Rachel Sklar, Media and Special Projects Editor for The Huffington Post. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, former Senator David Boren will be with us. He's written a compelling letter to America. He is now the president of the University of Oklahoma. All right, back to phone calls. We go to Gail from Madison. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I was just calling to say that while the New Yorker and the liberal folks may see the cover as satire, I'm still getting emails from, I hesitate to call them friends, but people I know who believe that Barack Obama is the Antichrist and that it says so in the Book of Revelations.
Wow.
And who believe that places like Snoops and Truth or Fiction are part of the liberal media establishment.
And who are these coming from, Gail?
Well, my son belongs to a Marine Corps unit that is in Iraq, and I belong to a group of parents of members of that Marine Corps unit.
Mm-hmm.
And the right-wing parents are a lot more vocal than the more liberal parents, and they post this garbage quite regularly on this Yahoo group. And I wind up quoting President Bush saying, "Muslims are not our enemy, terrorists are our enemy." And if anything ought to have shown us that Barack Hussein Obama is not a Muslim, it would be the flap about Reverend Wright. But if you have folks who believe that what I consider fairly mainstream websites like Truth or Fiction that say, you know, this is what's true and this is what's not true, are part of a left-wing plot, they'll believe whatever they want to believe, and the New Yorker cover is just playing into that.
Rachel?
Well, that is staggering. Well, Gail, good for you for speaking up. I think that you have just perfectly illustrated the point that this really is out there, and what can you do? You can either be silent and do nothing, or you can correct and point out and speak up. And if you are, you know, if you're the quieter voice or the lonely voice, well, lonely voices have never had it easy, but they've also been the voices that have made the most difference. So, yeah, I mean, to anybody who is in a position to correct falsehoods, absolutely. I think, listen, why would, this is what I wonder, genuinely, why would anybody prefer fiction over the truth? I just think that life is so much easier and everything is so much more straightforward where you actually know where things are coming from. I know that's an old-fashioned notion.
Sounds good to me, Rachel.
But Gail's point about the fact that this cover playing into that, mm-hmm. I mean, that's legitimate. So the question becomes, ought the New Yorker to not publish something like that if there are people out there who won't understand the joke? And where is there a public duty? Does a public duty exist? It's certainly the New Yorker is not an arm of the Obama campaign, owes the Obama campaign absolutely nothing, just owes the McCain campaign absolutely nothing. All they owe is fairness and, being correct. So I guess it comes down to, really, is this cartoon fair? That's the debate that's raging.
Thanks, Gail, for the call. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join us before Rachel has to go. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. In his letter to the editor in the New York Times today, Rachel, Senator Obama talked about Iraq and a plan for leaving Iraq, and also spent some time on Afghanistan, saying that he would be putting more brigades into Afghanistan. Will this become an issue, do you think, in the campaign, even more than Iraq, considering the death and violence that has increased in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, people are starting to remember that Afghanistan is a battlefront, and it's unfortunate that the only reason they're remembering is because it's getting so bad there and because American soldiers are dying there. So yes, this is becoming more of an issue, and I think it's part and parcel with the notion of progress in Iraq, balancing out the presence in Iraq versus the presence in Afghanistan, and really it goes back to resources. That has been a complaint from brigades in Afghanistan, is that they don't have the kind of support because resources are tied up in Iraq. But I think this is also part of, the perceived Obama quote-unquote flip-flop when he said he would refine his position on Iraq. I mean, I think it's crazy that people are somehow denigrating him for saying that he's going to take into account all new information in making the most up-to-date decision. But again, that's what you see happening in these elections. The to be a flip-flopper is one of the worst things that you can be branded with.
Mm-hmm. Back to the New Yorker for a moment. John from Appleton on an email says, the cover should not be considered offensive because most Americans do not read about the candidates, do not research their backgrounds, and actually believe the lies that covers like this infer.
Well, it's not most Americans. I mean, the numbers are much higher than they should be, i.e. zero, but they are. I mean, I think the last poll I saw where it said that people still believed Obama was a Muslim, I think I saw that this morning on Morning Joe on MSNBC, and I think it was 12%. Please don't quote me because I'm just getting that from my memory, but that's not most Americans. I mean, that's low. What can you do? Can you force feed information to people? Can you force them to read the newspaper? Can you force them to watch the news? Can you force them to, read from a multiple of reliable sources, credible sources on the internet? No, of course not. All you can do is hope that people will want to educate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What else can you do?
Right. Let's go to, we'll give you one more call and then go to Chase. Let's go to Kate. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm disturbed that the debate I hear everywhere seems to focus on whether or not Barack is Muslim, and I hear very little about the fact that in this country, of all countries, it shouldn't matter what a person's faith background is, and so that's what really disturbs me in all of this, that no one seems appalled that we are still in this country that was founded largely on purposes of religious freedom. None of us seem concerned that many of our friends and neighbors are troubled by someone not being a Christian. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, bravo. I mean, way to go, Kate. That's a real good point. I think there has been all too little focus. I agree, all too little focus on the fact that Muslim is being used as a smear. I think that plays into the fears in this country, the post 9/11 fears, and I'll quote President Bush here too. He has said, you know, Muslims are not the enemy; terrorists are the enemy. It's a small percentage of Muslims who believe in sort of the extremist jihad. It's very small. Unfortunately, there, you know, the actions of very few have gotten the most attention. But I agree. This is coming from Canada. I was raised and brought up in Canada. I do admit that the focus on religion in this campaign, sort of everybody pointing out about their faith and how much they pray and where they go to church and stuff. I have been surprised by that because I have always understood the separation of church and state to be, you know, like a Chinese wall. But I understand that this is an important element in this country, and its faith is important to people, and it's important to it's an important element of a person, sort of what they believe in, what principles govern their lives, and where their convictions spring from. But I would return to the sort of basic conviction, I guess, that's in the Constitution, which is all people are created equal and equal under God.
And Ed from Wausau.
Hi, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about the Phil Graham thing. On most of the media, they don't mention that Phil Graham was kind of in line to be McCain's, Treasury Secretary or whatever. Also, that two weeks ago, I watched a hearing chaired by two Michigan congressmen, Stupak and Dingell, and they had a 5-panel, 6.5-hour hearing where they're going after this rise in fuel prices. And one of the last participants was a former head of the futures market. Essentially, what he was saying was Phil Graham was the one that got through or pushed on a bill before Congress was going break on Christmas that no one actually read that opened up a loophole that's causing both the futures market trading in oil and also essentially the people that were these people were connected with Enron, and Phil Graham's wife was connected with Enron at the same time he was in Congress. And but essentially the relationship is to what's happening with the economy right now with both the mortgage market and the oil market. And Phil Graham was just no one brought that up in the national media. It seems like there's not even a brief history of what's happened before.
Well, first of all, I can't speak to the second thing that you brought up because I wasn't aware of that. Although, I definitely agree that there hasn't been much of a focus on Phil Graham in terms of his long history with McCain. Although I would disagree that nobody has mentioned it. I mean, I think that one of the reasons it was so amazing that McCain broke so openly and so quickly with Graham is because they are long-term friends and associates, and also because McCain has made a point in the past of grounding his economic strength, the economic strength of his campaign, on the fact that he has Phil Graham as an advisor. That was a cornerstone of his cred. So I do tend to agree. Now as far as sort of blaming the economy on Graham, I definitely have to go back to look into that because I wouldn't speak to it. But I do agree that sort of there's a lot of surface discussion and not as much delving when something like this happens. But I guess that's sort of the nature of media. You know, there are different levels. There are places where you can get the brief overview, and then there are places where you can get the 15,000-word article in the New Yorker. But people are going to look at the cover first, and then they'll read the article. So, mm-hmm.
Thanks very much, Ed, for the call. And Rachel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. That was terrific. Your listeners are great, by the way.
They are, aren't they?
Yeah.
They love to hear that, and it's true. Thanks. Rachel Sklar, media and special projects editor, Huffington Post, wrote a piece. If you want to go to HuffingtonPost.com, many of us don't have our New Yorkers yet for this week, but there's a rather controversial, that's an understatement, cover on the New Yorker, which you may want to look at. And then it's accompanied by a very, very lengthy article about mostly Barack Obama in Chicago, in the south side of Chicago, in Hyde Park, and dealing with daily politicians and an older generation and a younger generation, and it's very, very thorough. So we thank her for being with us. We're still on All Things Political. We're just changing our guest to a fairly regular guest now, Chase Martin. Chase is managing editor of the Iowa Independent, and our phone calls are remaining the same, as will our emails, as will our subject. We'll just branch into some new areas. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And again, our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Chase. Thanks so much for being with us. Oh, I'm sorry. I got Chase on the wrong line. Here we go. Hi, Chase.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good, good. What are you covering in the political world in Iowa these days, Chase?
We, of course, had some bad flooding for a while.
Oh, so, I know.
We were focused on that, even though we were still getting some visits from the presidential campaign. But we're still covering, you know, the high price of petroleum, which is hitting not just drivers here, but farmers and everybody on, you know, all ends of the food chain. So we've got, you know, a lot to talk about in terms of that down here in Iowa. But I was listening to the last half hour of your show, and it sounds like you've been talking about some interesting things, too.
Yeah. Let's talk about the flooding in Iowa. Have the candidates presented, do you think, plans to help you out in that state that was so hard hit?
You know, to be honest, so far it seems that both candidates have wanted to stay out of the politics of it. Both candidates had, you know, very notable photo ops sort of early on in the flooding. Obama had himself been sandbagging in Quincy, Illinois, and Senator McCain made a sort of unscheduled stop in between two fundraisers in Columbus Junction, which was one of the cities that was hit hardest by the flooding. So we've had photo ops and we've had some talk, but there hasn't been a whole lot of actual policy back and forth. Senator Obama had criticized McCain at one point for, you know, McCain's position against pork means he's against a lot of money that could have gone to levees along the Mississippi River and along the Iowa River here. But other than that, that was just sort of a shot across the bow, and there wasn't much else in the way of politics. I suspect that after it's a little bit further into people's memory, it'll maybe get talked about a little bit more, because it did affect, you know, several swing states, not just Iowa, but also Missouri, for instance.
Yes. It was terrible, wasn't it, Chase? It was just so terrible.
It was, and I was just over in the eastern part of Iowa yesterday, sort of driving around, and although the floodwaters receded 2 weeks ago, you know, the lingering damage is still just so, it's really devastating for a lot of the areas like Cedar Rapids, where, you know, half of their downtown area seems like it's, you know, unrecognizable still.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the presidential campaign, I would imagine that people in Iowa are looking for solutions to this so that it doesn't happen again. And from what you've said so far, I'm guessing that they're not very happy with response from either side.
Yes. You know, I think Iowans like to look at people in power when they're in the middle of a tragedy. And I think in general, people feel pretty good about the way our elected officials dealt with it. But, you know, this was supposed to be a 500-year flood, and this was the second time in 20 years that we've had it. So I think that it will also serve to inject some, you know, added focus on environmental policy and on global warming, to the extent that Iowans are starting to make that connection between the weather that we're having here. It hasn't just been flooding. You know, we've had several severe tornadoes that have caused deaths across the state. So the weather in general has not just, you know, been physically dangerous to us, it's also preventing a lot of farmers from getting their crops in the ground soon enough. And, you know, I think Iowans are beginning to understand the connection between environmental policy and sustainable agriculture and, you know, this whole mess that we've gotten ourselves into.
Mm-hmm. And it seems as though most of the rest of the country is understanding that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. John Anderson has been combing the web here this morning, and I'm interested in your response to this and what people in Iowa would think about this. I think this is a story that's got some legs. CNN reporting this morning that President Bush has lifted the executive ban on offshore drilling in Alaska. That's a controversial area.
It absolutely is. And I'm not sure, you know, I think it's going to make some folks angry, you know, those who are really interested in protecting, you know, offshore areas from drilling if they don't already have drilling in them. But I also think that, you know, the potential upside likely won't be seen while Bush is still in office. And I think that makes it an interesting choice because we all know when we begin to do more oil exploration, it will take, you know, 5-10 years before we really see the benefits at, you know, in the prices at the pump. So I'm a little bit surprised by that simply because, you know, he's going to get criticized from the folks who oppose it, and the folks who support it, they won't be vindicated until long after he leaves office.
Yeah. How important is Iowa? Where are you guys leaning? How many visits are you going to get from McCain and Obama?
So far, both campaigns seem to think that, you know, we're in the top tier, as they say, of swing states. We will house a regional office for the McCain campaign, although the regional structure of his campaign has been sort of deprecated. But we will have a regional office for his campaign, and the Obama campaign already has about 30 staff in the state. We actually published a story on Iowa Independent just last week comparing the numbers, and Senator Obama has definitely put more resources into Iowa so far, but the McCain campaign pledged to us on the phone when we talked to them that they were going to send as many staffers to Iowa per capita as they have anywhere.
Mm-hmm. We certainly were struck when we were in Iowa by the number of on-the-ground volunteers from Chicago and elsewhere for Obama. It was an impressive sight. It was very impressive.
Of course, everything will be dwarfed by what you saw during the caucuses, Kathleen.
Right.
I don't think it'll get that crazy again for another 4 years.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Well, are people able to function okay, though? Has the flooding receded enough and things are back to normal so that you can carry on a presidential campaign in parts of Iowa?
Yes, and in fact, it was a bit remarkable just in terms of the way, you know, the affected areas are still certainly devastated by the floods, but the recovery was very quick. And except for the buildings that are, you know, actually damaged so that you can't go in them, all of the buildings that, you know, needed to be cleaned out are cleaned out. Folks are now, you know, working more on the residential parts of town. But, you know, it has been pretty well localized in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City and a few of the other cities along the Mississippi River and in southeast Iowa. But in general, you know, our infrastructure is back. Our National Guard did a really great job sandbagging all of the water treatment plants across all the small towns. So we're in pretty good shape for recovery right now.
And it always brings out the best of America. You keep thinking that the government should just pour whatever they've got, but they can't because it's all in Iraq and Afghanistan. But people ought to be pouring in tons and tons of money. But instead, you see, which lifts your heart, all of these people who were just doing sandbagging were just coming in from 200 miles away, regular citizens, to help out.
Right, absolutely. And probably the most heart-wrenching moment was when after everyone had been spending all the, you know, this great community effort sandbagging, the levee would still breach and all of the effort would be for naught. But it was still definitely a heartwarming scene.
Right. Let's go to phone calls. Chase Martin is with us this half hour, and Chase is managing editor for the Iowa Independent. It's all things political. We're talking about the campaign strategy at work in Iowa and how the flood enters into all of that. Iowa, of course, an incredibly important state for launching Barack Obama, and we welcome your phone calls on the campaign. 800-486-8655. Or 227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. Or if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we will be speaking with former Senator David Born, who's the author of A Letter to America. He's now the president of the University of Oklahoma, and he has a lot to say in this book. It's a short book, but he says that it's a wake-up call to Americans, addressing the question of how long the U.S., with only 6% of the world's population, can remain a global superpower. He will be with us, hour number two. Two phone calls now for Chase. Chase Martin is managing editor of the Iowa Independent, and we go to Pat from Milwaukee. Hi, Pat.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Pat.
Hey, I guess I just have a couple of questions. I'm just taking issue with a couple of the comments made. I guess the first one I'd just like to touch on real briefly as far as the governmental aid. You know, I think actually FEMA's done a pretty good job. I think most people have agreed on that here in Wisconsin, at least. And if you recall, downtown Milwaukee, they had a little problem with food stamps a few weeks ago, where the government opened up, you know, for Milwaukee County, additional food stamps for those affected by flooding. Well, in fact, what we saw was, you know, the entire north side of Milwaukee, for all intents and purposes, lining up around the building, taking that aid that was specifically designated for flood victims, just because it's another cheap government handout. So, yeah, there's a ton of money in Iraq and, you know, Afghanistan, but there's still a lot of money wasted, you know, in other aspects. I guess my second comment was just, you know, I was listening to the speaker, and I was just waiting for the global warming comment to be brought up. And I get a little frustrated when we talk about tornadoes and a flood, and somehow that's the cause of global warming, when really we've been in a 10-year cooling period, and scientists, you know, in the Pacific Ocean have noticed water temperatures going down. So my comment is, yeah, there might be some long-term global warming going on, but the Earth cycles, and the carbon in the atmosphere really has not gone up that significantly at all. And is it made by, you know, mankind or, you know, plants, animals, et cetera? I just think there's a lot of scientists out there, including the head guy in the Weather Channel, that thinks, you know, we might be blowing this out of proportion. And I think to put the entire economy in jeopardy, take a look at a problem that might be false is a mistake.
Well, to go back to those people who were waiting in line, Pat, they were hungry.
Sure, they were hungry, but that food was specifically designated, you know, for those flood victims. There are also programs for those people that are hungry.
Not enough.
You know, it's normal.
Not enough, Pat. Not enough.
I believe so, because I've actually have known people that needed that for a while because they've lost their job. And there was actually money left over in the budget in Milwaukee County last year. They almost had a marketing campaign to tell more people to come down and use it so they could get the same amount of federal money last year. And if you look, you know, that's a true statement.
Well, I drive through the city on the way to work, and I can't tell you how number of people the number of people who are sitting out churches waiting for food, there are a lot. Do you want to take on the global warming issue, Chase?
I think that's in some ways a pretty fair point. I don't think that the average voter is sort of making that. I don't think that average voter is sort of making that grand scientific argument where they're connecting the carbon in the atmosphere to what's going on. I think the average voter just sort of looks out of their window, sees that the weather is just so vastly different from what they remember even 5 or 10 years
right.
ago. And, you know, they sort of remember what they've always known in the back of their mind, which is we know that we're doing things that are bad for the environment, whether or not it's causing global warming or simply just, you know, because we're diverting the rivers for irrigation and for our agriculture and putting certain things in the rivers, that we make the situation more volatile. So even if, you know, the scientific arguments aren't precisely correct about how much carbon we have in the atmosphere, I don't really think that most voters are operating on that level. I think they're simply, you know, realizing what they've known all along, which is that we should be better stewards of the environment, and certain things can go wrong, and it'll just be difficult for us to understand and to explain for a while. You know, I think most people are just thinking on that level.
Mm-hmm. Well, the presidential candidates are thinking on the level of making a huge industry out of green, right? I mean, both of them have given us that kind of philosophy. What do you think of that, and how does that play in Iowa?
I think it certainly plays great in Iowa, which is home not only to corn ethanol, which has certainly been the subject of a lot of scorn over the past couple of months, but also, you know, we're right in that wind corridor where, you know, a lot of folks are saying we should be building a lot of wind power plants, and it's definitely a growth industry. I think both candidates have latched onto it because they realize, you know, in the Midwest, it's probably the greatest source for economic growth of any sector that we have in the country. So I think it's convenient politically, but it's also probably important that, you know, particularly in the Midwest, we focus on renewables because we have so many resources to be able to do it here.
Right. Let's go to Mary next from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I'm always interested in hearing guests from the Midwest. It's a neglected area. But what I wanted to say was, I remember reading a few years ago in a history book that no peasants' revolt has ever succeeded. The leaders were generally terribly tortured to death, except perhaps for the French Revolution, which struck terror into the heart of Britain. I've listened to Obama now for quite a while, and it's impossible not to be caught up in the excitement of his campaign and all these wild promises. But it concerns me greatly that we all seem to be reacting to his promise, implied promise, to do things he can't possibly do. I hear him implying when he's in Detroit that he can bring back the automotive jobs. Not unless, of course, we're going to make a law that no American can do business outside the country or buy cars made elsewhere. I hear him implying that he understands it's not fair that CEOs make much more money than the line workers, and he's going to make that right. And my first question is, while some people say this is just politics and, of course, he can't do those things, I meet many people that somehow think he can overturn the basic structure of this country and make us all much more economic equals. When it becomes clear that Obama cannot do these things, no president has that kind of unilateral power, and world events are against us, what will the reaction be? And what can Obama actually do other than say, well, I tried, when he becomes president? Question two is, I'm not a bit surprised that Bush has opened up the reserves. This is only the beginning of digging potholes all over the country. But I would love to hear what your guest thinks about who's going to have the cojones to shut down the drunken party. I remember going a few years ago to some kind of mechanical event, and we didn't realize that the break in the middle was going to be five-year-old dirt bike racing. And on the one hand, these little peewee dirt bikers were adorable. They were dressed in, I would guess, nearly $1,000 worth of miniature adult leather gear. And they spent a lot of time falling down, but a few of them were ahead of their peers, as five-year-olds are. And they did a heck of a job. But all I can think these days is, why on earth do we need five-year-old dirt bike racing? Why do we need adult dirt bike racing? Snowmobile racing. How much worse will things get? Certainly England goes on, and their gas is 3 and 4 times the cost of ours. How much worse will things get before somebody starts to say, we don't need these things, we don't need personal watercraft? Who's going to shut down the party? And that is that.
That is that, Mary. Chase, who's going to shut down the party?
I actually want to start with the first question that the caller asked, which was, on, you know, what's going to happen when Senator Obama isn't able to deliver on all of his promises. And I do think that there's a danger that a lot of these idealistic youngsters who have gotten involved are going to be disappointed a bit. But I also think that, you know, it's a bit unfair to say that the president can't do anything to, for instance, help the auto industry. A big argument that Senator Obama makes on that is, you know, the reason why the auto industry in Detroit seems to be failing is that they're spending so much money in health care costs and on their pension plan. And Senator Obama's argument is, we will compete with the European and the Japanese car makers when we have as robust a universal health care system as those countries do. And that will, in turn, lower the pension costs so much for these car companies that they're going to be in much better shape going forward. It's really the pension costs and the health care costs for retirees that's crippling the auto companies right now. And then, of course, there's the argument that to make them more competitive, the country needs to enact higher CAFE standards, fuel economy standards, which should also, he argues, Obama argues, make them more competitive with the European and the Japanese cars. But aside from that, you know, I do think that there's something to be said for asking Americans to sacrifice a bit and to lay off their fuel consumption. Both candidates seem very happy to sort of pay lip service to that idea. Whether or not anyone is really in a position to stop people from using as much gas as they do, let alone whether anyone will have the political will to try, I'm not sure. I do think that that's a bigger question than, you know, the easier sort of policy questions surrounding our economy. I do think that actually getting people to consume less fuel is probably not, a really easy thing to do. I do think, though, that opposing things like the gas tax holiday that Senator Obama opposes and Senator McCain supports, you know, those I think are probably as tough a stand as we're ever going to see against something that would likely increase our fuel consumption. Whether anyone will ever support, say, an increase in the gas tax with gas prices as high as they are, I doubt it. So I think while we might see some of the more strong-willed politicians opposing gas tax decreases, I don't think we're going to see anybody proposing an increase in the gas tax, which is probably the only thing that would that the government could do to stem consumption.
Well, we're already driving smaller cars, right?
That's certainly true. At least some of us are.
Yeah, right. Chase, thanks so much for being with us. As always, we'll check in again.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Chase Martin, managing editor of the Iowa Independent, and before that, Rachel Sklar, media and special projects editor of the Huffington Post for our All Things Political segment. We do these every Monday at 9, and we'll continue to do so until somebody is elected president of the United States. And then we'll keep track of what that person is doing, so it will continue. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program, to John Anderson for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thank you for listening. Ed on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.